This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We start the Friday news review with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Chris, thanks for coming back down.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also alongside our friend Chris is our other friend, Jay Hanselman from right here at WVXU. Jay, thanks for taking the time.
It was such a long trip to get here.
I know, it's a long walk. And this is usually when you're having your sandwich, so I always appreciate when
and
you join
my 18
us.
Pringles.
And your 18 Pringles. One of these days I'm going to snap.
You count them out?
I'm going to steal one of those.
That's
one of these days.
He never shares. Container.
It's my favorite chip. He never shares with me. But we do have some breaking news to start with, it sounds like, because Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley has issued a statement to multiple media outlets that says, quote, "I am exploring a run for governor because Ohio is falling behind and must do better." He goes on to say, "For years, Ohio's middle class has been shrinking under the weight of the state's failed policies. Cincinnati's comeback, population, and job growth that buck Ohio's overall track record is a better way forward." So let's start by talking about Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley's apparent future political plans. He has been on this program and talked to you all as well about the Cincinnati comeback. He's been touting this. Does this play statewide somehow, Chris?
You know, we'll see. It's been a long time since a mayor has gone directly from City Hall to the governor's office. I think George Voinovich from Cleveland was probably the last one to do it, and he was a Republican. You know, it could play. I mean, we'll see. I think that he's going to have a lot of competition in the primary because I think Nan Whaley, the mayor of Dayton, who is his good friend, which makes this kind of an interesting move for him, is also thinking about running. She obviously has gotten a lot of national press for all of the things that Dayton has had to go through lately with the mass shootings and tornadoes and all kinds of tragedies. So she... her statewide and her national profile has been rising. I'm not sure that Mayor Cranley's is on the same level nationally and maybe statewide that hers is. But that's why you start running for governor this far in advance, is to build up your statewide recognition, because this is a big state and it's really composed of a bunch of different little states in my mind. You know, Northeast Ohio is completely different than Southern Ohio. And so... you know, he's going to have a lot of work to do, and it's probably good politically for him to get started.
You raise a very interesting point about Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, who we've also talked to about her future plans. She's publicly coy about them, but there may be some machinations taking place behind the scenes. You would have to, and we don't like to assume, but they are close. So what would we think? Would we think that they would have had some kind of conversation before John Cranley made this announcement?
I've got no inside knowledge on that, unfortunately, so I don't know. You know, they even share similar, you know, they've similar operatives sometimes. So you assume he will have a conversation if he hasn't already had one.
Okay.
And she would talk to him as well.
Well, you mentioned that it's not an easy path for municipal leaders to go directly to the governor's
office.
And
a Democrat.
State, and a Democrat, certainly. What about Cincinnati area politicians in general and their appeal statewide? This is me maybe putting you on the spot, but we did just get this information.
Sure, let's do it.
I mean, is there any type of, I guess, precedence for local people running in a statewide election?
When I think of the history of the state and the folks that have ascended to statewide office from Cincinnati, they are generally Republicans.
Rob Portman,
Bob Taft, Joe Dieters at one point. Those are the three names that immediately stick out from recent history. Way back, John Gilligan was a congressman in Cincinnati, and he became governor for one term. Really one of the state's great governors, John Gilligan. And so it's been a while since we've had somebody prominent really ascend from the Democratic side to statewide office. So I got to say, this makes total sense. John views himself as an executive type of person. And so it doesn't surprise me that he would want to run for governor. I wrote a cover story on the mayor's race back in 2017. And at that time, right in the lead, it said that he had told business leaders at that time that he was thinking about running for governor as his next move. So this is not exactly a surprise. It's not shocking. I think that he has been considering this for a long, long time.
And I guess we should note, since John Cranley would be running in a Democratic primary if he were to actually launch a campaign. Right now, it just says he's exploring a run.
Right.
We're more than 2 years away from that primary. That's a lifetime away in politics. And we still have to get through the 2020 elections, which includes a presidential campaign. So the whole lay of the land could be starkly different than they are right now.
and the 2021 race for mayor in Cincinnati. That's how far this is away. We have two major elections locally and nationally that come first. So it's really striking how far in advance this is starting.
Well, while we have Chris and Jay here, we're happy to take your phone calls. If you have some questions, they love answering questions, especially ones they were not previously prepared to answer. So give us a call at 513-419-7100, and we'll take your calls and maybe get to Twitter and Facebook as well. If you launch some comments at us there, or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Listen, John Cranley's late Friday morning announcement was not the only movement at City Hall this week of significance outside of the city. We want to talk about Republican City Councilwoman Amy Murray. She's leaving council.
Right.
And
right.
She's moving to Washington. Right. Let's bring Jay in. Hi, Jay. You've been curiously quiet.
You've been silent, man.
So what is happening
Chris
with Amy
Murray? Chris talks politics better than I do.
All right.
I mean, I don't think this was a surprise. I think we both ask Amy. She's been secretly, quietly working on trying to get a job with the Trump administration for, I think she told us, almost a year.
It's about a year, yeah.
It's good for her, but probably more than anything, it's good for the Hamilton County Republican Party, because Republicans on Cincinnati City Council are an endangered species. And if they hope to maintain the two seats that they have right now, her seat and Councilmember Jeff Pastor, it's clearly to their advantage to have an incumbent running for re-election in 2021. And the longer that person can be an incumbent, the better their chances potentially of being victorious in 2021. I did think it was interesting, if you go to our website, Howard Wilkinson thinks that it's sort of a waste of time.
He dismissed all of our – we were worked up about it, but he said we shouldn't be.
Howard's been at this a long time.
He seems to think that even if they do appoint someone, that that their chances are very slim, and could be, but we'll find out in 2021. But first, we have to find out who this person's going to be.
And how does that process work?
So the two members – so council cycle, every member of council fills out what they call a successor designation form. And so each council member says, I want council member X to pick my replacement in case I resign or pass away, or, you know, whatever could happen that you would leave council. And so in this case, Amy Murray has picked Jeff Pastor and Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman. The Vice Mayor, of course, is an independent, but he's kind of been known to lead, you know, conservatively at times. And of course, Pastor is a fellow Republican, the only other Republican on city council. And so they will officially make the selection. Murray told us earlier this week that she expects to pick her own replacement, but she's leading a process through the Hamilton County GOP to kind of vet and look at applicants. So it's an open, you know, it's open process in the sense that anybody who wants to apply could do so and attempt to get this appointment.
What kind of names have emerged so far that we know of?
All kinds. I mean, the you know, one that you've heard probably before in Cincinnati is Pete Whitty, the West Side activist. He's a small business owner. That's a name I've heard. Jason Williams, the columnist at The Enquirer, really promoted a guy named Steve Gooden, who is an attorney, really kind of favored by 4th Street, the business community. They really like him. But there are other names that maybe you've never heard of. I heard today the president of the Sailor Park Community Council, whose name is escaping me as we speak. But that was somebody who might apply, and some other ones as well. So we'll see.
If you are interested, the deadline to apply, I think, is next Wednesday, February the 19th at 5 o'clock. And the Hamilton County Republican Party will send you a questionnaire that you can fill out and send back, and you can be a part of the process.
Have you applied, Jay? Do you know what's on the questionnaire?
I don't live in the city.
That's true. You know, you're not going to. I found his name, though, the guy I was talking about, Garrett Gerard, president of Sailor Park Community Council.
Well, while we're talking about the, I guess, how this shapes the 2021 council race, and in spite of the way WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson may dismiss this pick, what position do we think Amy Murray would have been in for a re-election? Would she have been a safe position?
She's barred from running for re-election, which is why she's, I think, trying to take the DC job. But I think, you know, Amy raised a lot of money in 2017, and she came in 8th. Before the election before, she came in 9th. Before that, she'd run a couple times. I think it was 11th 12th.
12th, both times 12th.
So it's it shows the tough road. I think people like Amy, though. She's a very kind person, and you know, there are definitely some issues that people disagree on, but I feel like she would have been well positioned if if you could seek a third term.
And that's another when I was talking about the endangered species of Republicans on council. You know, in her best race, Amy finished eighth. Jeff Pastor in 2017 finished ninth, and it was just by a couple of hundred votes. It actually went to a recount. I mean, they did an automatic recount when they did the official canvas, and it was, you know, like 200 votes.
It does tend to take a couple of tries for particularly political newcomers before right. they can get on. So a lot of times it seems like these candidates are running to introduce themselves with the idea that, although, you know, whatever the case may be, 2 or 4 years later, make another shot.
I sort of think, though, that next year's is going to be a free-for-all because you're going to have six open seats with the exception of with Amy, if that person's an incumbent, but be the first time they'd be running for election. I've even heard that there could be seven open seats, and I don't think that's ever happened, and that's going to be
a starkly different city hall. 513-419-7100 is the number to call. Let's go to the phones. We have Sandy on the line. Hi, Sandy. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I like your program a lot. I listen to it.
Thank you.
My comment is about Mayor Nan Whaley. I heard her speak last night. She is inspirational. She's down to earth. She works in a community like all mayors do where the rubber meets the road. I think since she has national or at least Ohio name recognition, she should run for senator against Ron. I think we need someone who is in the trenches every day as mayors are up in Washington.
Sandy, we appreciate the call very much. Thank you for calling in, and thank you so much for listening. So there's a perspective from an Ohio voter who says Nan Whaley may be better served as a senatorial candidate. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see how the political chips fall and what comes next. Moving on about city council and the Hamilton County government, Jay, it looks like these two government entities may have been bickering a little bit again over the Metropolitan Sewer District.
I'm shocked.
Okay, well, what's the latest here?
Well, MSD stands for Metropolitan Sewer District. It would probably be better if it was Metropolitan Sewer Disagreement.
Oh, Jay Hanselman.
The city and the county just do not get along well when it comes to the sewer district. The latest dust up, they had to couple years ago submit a plan to federal regulators under the federal consent decree to reduce the amount of sewer overflows into local streams during heavy rain events. They completed phase one. They have to come up with a plan for phase two. Hamilton County submitted one plan. The city of Cincinnati, as the manager of the Metropolitan Sewer District, presented their own plan, and regulators looked at that as a violation of the consent decree that since they didn't submit one plan, the regulators were going to do their own plan, which they released in July, I think. And so between July and January, the MSD has been doing a validation of what federal regulators proposed, and they come up with a plan that's like $938 million, just short of $1 billion. And MSD has done a report on that and found out that really they can only afford to do about half of the projects that were in what the regulators proposed. What upset the commission yesterday and led to some fireworks, they didn't know about this report. They didn't know it was being submitted. They said that they were left out of the process of contributing to it to provide input. And they were also upset that at the end of December, they were talking with MSD about their operating and capital budgets. And MSD at the time knew that over the next 10 years, this program could actually cost $1 billion more than what they thought. And that could lead to some pretty significant rate increases. And that wasn't brought to the commissioner's attention in December when they were making all these budget decisions. So they were not very happy.
Any examples of how they were unhappy? Were there any particular comments that stood out?
Denise Driehaus said it was a bad, poor way to do business. Commissioner Victoria Parks made the comment, there's a federal judge that's overseeing all this, that MSD should just call the federal judge and say, we have no intention of involving or working with the county commission. Stop wasting the judge's time and our time and citizens' money and move forward.
What a scathing remark by her. I read your story. I unfortunately did not get to attend the commissioner meeting yesterday, but they were really kind of out for blood yesterday with Diana Christie.
And this all, I mean, part of this, they're waiting on there's a couple of decisions that they really need a federal judge to make, and these have been pending since last April. One of them is that it would force the MSD to accept the county's plan that was submitted to federal regulators, which was for about $450 million and would cover 5 years. The city's plan was, like $793 million, and it covers 10 years. And then there's also one pending before the judge that would essentially, and this is the big hang-up, the management of MSD would now work for Hamilton County and report to the Hamilton County Commissioners as opposed to the Cincinnati City Manager.
And you are listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. This is the Friday News Review, and we are joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wederick and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Let's talk about downtown development, Chris, because this Millennium Hotel situation, which we've had you on to talk about multiple times in the past, leading up to ultimately its plan to be redeveloped. Well, it looks like that plan took a pretty big step forward this week.
It did. And it's also kind of involved in a bit of a political scrape that kind of happened yesterday. So just to back up, the Port of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority, the board that runs that gave its CEO, Laura Brunner, the authority on Wednesday to go out and sign a construction manager contract with Turner Construction, which does a ton of work downtown and, you know, really across the region. She said the one thing that they're doing here is kind of bypassing competitive bidding for that top level contract. And she said basically the reason for that is they are an experienced contractor in building convention center hotels and convention center expansions, and that they're basically the best people for the job. So the port board unanimously granted her the authority to do that. Yesterday, Eric Kearney, the former state lawmaker and CEO of the African American Chamber, said, hey, no, wait a minute. We want a chance to bid, we being potential minority contractors. We want a chance to bid on that project, and we think the process should be opened up for competitive bidding. And we basically object to this. And so that's kind of a big deal. Kearney has really raised the profile of the African American Chamber since he's been running it over the last several years. And so that has definitely caught everyone's attention.
Well, so, what does that mean? If it's caught everyone's attention, is there any possible action or reconsideration of what's gone down?
It's unclear. The port statement yesterday about Kearney's remarks said, well, it emphasized that two things, really. One, they haven't actually let the contract yet. They haven't signed on the dotted line. And then the other thing was that the subcontracts that Turner bids will be open bidding. So the potential to get work for minority firms goes, you know, it could go through the subcontracts. And that's kind of been the port's case for this all along. Kearney still objects to it, though. And, you know, Turner and the port say that they have a really good record on minority inclusion. They pointed to their numbers on the FC Cincinnati project, which has exceeded the 25% minority business enterprise goal. And so they believe that they're not doing anything wrong here. But Kearney is saying, look, we need an open process here.
And you reported that the port wants to move on this because the Millennium Hotel is in poor condition and apparently it costs $100,000 a month to cover its utilities.
Yeah, there was some discussion about the heating system being quote unquote compromised. I'm not exactly clear what that means. I walked through it the other day looking at, you know, the sale that they had going on. So it seemed like the heat was on at least then. You know, the city and the county have always emphasized what a decrepit state this hotel is in. Sometimes I wonder, frankly, whether they're overstating it a little bit. I've toured the hotel under the previous owners, who obviously everyone had issues with. But nevertheless, they're saying this is something that's vital to get done quickly. And so they've basically said, Turner, you're going to demolish this thing. And then when we come up with a plan to redevelop it, and what we're going to do with it, then you're going to build that as well.
So we don't know exactly what could land on that site yet.
No, we had a cover story last week that I co-wrote with Tom Demaropoulos that really dived into all of those issues. Basically, there's a study going on by the Cincinnati Business Committee and the CV, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, trying to figure out just exactly what they should build there. How big a hotel? They know they need a hotel. That's pretty much going to be built. We know that. But they need to know how big should it be, and should we try to tack on a convention center expansion possibly across Elm Street along with it? And so that's the major question holding things up.
Now, and so while the port is handling this, who ultimately pays for that development?
Right, exactly. So the $54 million so far has been allocated from the county's share of the hotel tax. That will demolish the hotel, and that will purchase the hotel. Yeah. So after that, they need to come up with a financing plan.
And they've got, what is it, 3 years? Because basically the bonds that they've issued are for 3 years. So there's a gigantic, if you're like a balloon payment at the end, that they've got between now and 2023 to figure out what they're going to do, or they're going to owe a whole lot of money to some bondholders if they don't have a plan.
The idea is to refinance the whole thing in a way. So it's a little bit – somebody compared it, and I think they would chafe at this description and quibble with it. But it's got some truth to it, that it's one of those mortgages that you're – you know, you've got to refinance.
It's a balloon payment at the end.
Yeah.
Well, our Ann Thompson here at WVXU went and checked out the Millennium Hotel's auction sale of some of its innards and properties. So did either of you pick up anything?
I didn't buy anything. They were out of TVs by the time I got there. Plus, I think
the TVs went like in the first hours.
Best to disinfect whatever you bought there. it's got a reputation for bed bugs.
No mattresses?
Definitely not.
My thanks to Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Jay, I know you're hungry. You'll get your sandwich and your Pringles so that you're in a better mood when we talk later here. You're too sad on this show today. So this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now with a look at the Democratic primary in the Hamilton County Sheriff's race and new homeless shelter regulations in Covington. We are joined by Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman. Welcome back, Scott. Been a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Our pleasure. And Julia Fair, thank you for coming back in as well.
Yeah, good to be here.
Absolutely. 513-419-7100 is our number if you'd like to make a call. Scott, let's start with your coverage of this Democratic primary for Hamilton County Sheriff. This looks like it's shaping up to be one of the more contentious races of season. Tell us about Jim Neal and Charmaine McGuffey. You took a nice deep dive in this and what the state of that primary is right now.
How much time do I have? Where do you want me to begin?
Technically, we have 10 minutes for this whole segment. So can you do it in 11 seconds?
I'll do what I can. It's a very personal race. They have kind of known each other their whole lives, which actually I did not know until I started writing it. But they grew up on the west side together. They're a year apart. They went to Western Hills High School, graduated a year apart. They went to UC in the same program, and they joined the Sheriff's Department at about the same time, 1981 and 1983, respectively. So you'd think they'd have a lot in common, but this primary is kind of shaped up to be almost like a general election, because Jim Neal is a very conservative Democrat. He's made no secret about that. And Charmaine McGuffey, who is the and actually I don't know if I introduced the candidates here, but it's
Jim Neal and Charmaine McGuffey.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and Charmaine McGuffey, who's a former sheriff's deputy, she appeals to the progressive crowd, and that's why she got the endorsement from the Democratic Party, which was a very unusual move for a party not to endorse their incumbent.
It was a strange thing. You know, I live tweeting is a thing that reporters do. Sometimes it's not interesting. Sometimes it is. But I was glued to your Twitter feed that day and Chris Wetterich's Twitter feed that day, because this was an absolutely captivating experience as the party internally decided who they were going to throw their support behind. But that's how polarizing this race is.
Yeah. And it was interesting, too, because Jim Neal was kind of doing a little bit of in-person trolling, I think, because he came in a red hat. And it was a union hat, but the knock that he's gotten, he's worn a Make America Great hat around the office. He says it was just to get a rise out of people. But the thing that has been following Jim Neal around this whole campaign, and actually for this last term, he attended a Trump rally in 2016 in Westchester. He was on stage. There are photos of him smiling there. He said he came at the behest of Sheriff Richard Jones in Butler County, which is a whole nother problem, because Sheriff Richard Jones is a very conservative, hardline immigration, illegal immigration stance that also is not a friend of many Democrats. His relationship and friendship with Richard Jones is also another problem that he's had to overcome with Democrats. Now, it hasn't hurt Jim Neal in general elections. He's easily won re-election the two times he's won, but he's never had a primary challenge, and that's going to be the key here. Can he survive that?
You have a sub-headline in this story that I absolutely love, because it's basically my LinkedIn bio. What happened in Covington? Does it matter? So what happened in Covington and does it matter?
Well, yeah, that's and it's hard to say whether it does matter or doesn't matter, but Charmaine was this was in 2010. she was leaving a bar in Covington. It's now closed. I think it was the Blue Bar, actually. I can't remember. She's openly gay. And these cops, exactly what happened is not quite clear. But a police officer approached her and her friends leaving the bar. She claims that she was just calling the police officer out for targeting a gay bar.
And this is a bar that has a sort of history with having to deal with this is the same bar where an act of violence had taken place. So
around that
same period, yeah, okay. Blue Bar, yeah.
I did not know that, but then the cop said that she yelled obscenities at him, was very belligerent. So he cited her for disorderly conduct and public intoxication. Now, the charges were dropped a few days after that. The Covington police decided not to pursue it. She was never brought to court, but she was suspended for 5 days. Now, why this matters now is in 2018, the prosecutor, the Hamilton County prosecutor, asked for an updated list of any infractions that deputies and police officers have to put on a list that they call the Brady List. I won't go into details on the specifics of that, but they just keep that so because they have to disclose by law, there's case law, if there's anything, marks of misconduct on a police officer's record to any defense attorneys. The prosecutor says this matters only if a defense attorney in a specific case decides to make an issue of it. From attorneys I've talked to, it probably won't become an issue, but Jim Mueller's used it to attack her credibility.
Well, we have several weeks still for that race to get dirtier, I suppose.
Yeah, it's going to be a bloodbath.
I'm going to ask you about a couple of other important politicians in just a moment. Let's go ahead and bring Julia Fair in, your colleague from The Inquirer who covers Northern Kentucky. And this is another reference of what happened in Covington, I suppose, because something did happen at City Hall this week. The City Commission adopted new rules for homeless shelters. This took months and months and months.
So this really started in October. That is when a draft ordinance was really leaked to the media, and there were some standards in there that advocates for people experiencing homelessness had problems with. There were location restrictions within 1,000 feet of public schools, parks, it went on, and there was also a standard that said that the shelters had to have bike racks. But since then, those most critiqued aspects of the ordinance have been nixed from the bill. They're not in it anymore. So last week, the city passed the ordinance, and now they have new standards.
And so the standards that were included, it still seems like some significant change for these shelters, including like basically around-the-clock operations.
Yeah. So the emergency shelter of Northern Kentucky, they were not a 24-hour operation. Now they have to be. So it's open 24 hours, access to toilets, showers. There's also a limit now on how long somebody can stay at the shelter. Someone can only stay at the shelter for 150 days out of a year. That's new. And now there has to be a waiting area, too, for people waiting to get into the shelter every day.
And you and I were both at Covington City Hall when this vote took place. And maybe you got a better gauge than I did, because I wasn't completely clear on how some of the agency representatives, whether they be from the board or actual directors of the homeless shelters, truly felt. You saw a couple say that we appreciate that we got to negotiate this and we're happy with where it is. One agency asked for basically an extension. Can we hold off on a vote until we figure out some more of these details? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I did talk to Kim Webb. She is the director of the Emergency Shelter of Northern Kentucky. I talked to her after the meeting, and I said, are you concerned about what your representative brought up, asking for an extension to make sure all of the zoning matters are taken care of? And she told me, no, that we are going to take the mayor's verbal confirmation that there's not going to be a problem with zoning. So it doesn't seem like they're saying that they're worried about it anymore.
Okay, well, we'll have to continue to watch and see how that unfolds. Scott Wortman from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Sherrod Brown got into President Trump's crosshairs recently, and his wife, too, apparently. A little strange thing, but you got to write a story about Sherrod Brown and his accusation that President Trump has gone on a retribution tour and has turned the White House into a personal vengeance operation. What prompted the senator from Ohio, the Democrat, to say those things?
Well, all the basically all the dismissals of the impeachment witnesses, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. I'm not going to get some of the titles here mixed up, but because there are so many, there's a huge roster of characters in
it's,
this.
It's kind of hard to keep up with what's going on any day, whether local or national. So it's to be understood.
As someone mentioned, like, remember that time we were trying to buy Greenland? I'm like, that's a that's a complete.
A lifetime ago, and maybe a missed opportunity.
But basically, yeah, I mean, Sherrod Brown has been one of the more vocal Democrats, actually. And it's kind of interesting. The New York Times ran op-eds from both Sherrod Brown and Rob Portman. So Ohio's senators have kind of been the spokespeople for their respective parties. But on the Senate floor, or not actually, it was a committee meeting. He basically just said that the acquittal gave Trump a blank check, basically, to do whatever he wants, no accountability. And so, yeah, he's not holding back.
Yeah, he's been increasingly vocal about these, and we'll have to see what comes next. Well, I saw that Senator Sherrod Brown's wife shared a video, so they seem to be unfazed by the remarks the president made because it was just a Sherrod playing with his dogs at home, and they seem to be having a good time. So
Franklin is a big, very popular. I think he could run for office as well.
Is that the dog's name?
Yeah.
Well done. That shows you're very insidery with your political knowledge.
Well, he was Franklin played a big role when Sherrod Brown was considering running for president. So
all right.
That lasted for about a month though, and he decided, no. But Rob Portman hasn't really. He's called the president out saying he thought it was inappropriate, but he doesn't think it was merited removal. So basically, I mean, he's siding with Republicans, Sherrod Brown siding with the Democrats. So,
what do you know?
Yeah.
Julia Fair, also from The Enquirer, we've had you on a couple times to talk about both that homeless shelter situation and also Judge Dawn Gentry, Kenton County Family Court judge. We had you on because she's obviously facing disciplinary action, is currently suspended from the bench, and was facing a further hearing that's coming up later in the spring here locally. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, some action in Frankfort could lead to an impeachment there?
Yes. So Kenton County Family Court Judge Dawn Gentry could be the fifth individual ever to be impeached by Kentucky's legislator.
Ever.
It's only happened four times. Out of those four, only two have been actually convicted. But the process has started. It started with Representative Joseph Fisher. He represents parts of Campbell County. He filed a... Let's see. What's the word? He filed a resolution last week to appoint members to a committee to determine if there should be another investigation to see if this judge should be impeached. So now Judge Gentry is facing disciplinary from the Judicial Conduct Commission, but that's not going to continue until April. And now she's facing it on the legislature as well. Both could remove her from office, so we're just going to have to see what happens next.
Well, let's just very quickly remind our listeners as best we can, and I know it's a litany of charges, but let's just summarize the big ticket items.
Sure. I actually have a list.
Yeah. Well, let's hear why Judge Dawn Gentry from the courthouse in Covington is facing trouble.
Sure. So she is facing 9 misconduct charges from the state. That includes coercion to participate in her judicial campaign, retaliation for failure to support that campaign. There's also some things in there about falsifying timesheets, retaliation against school employees, holding meetings with some guardian ad litem panel members without the other lawyers in the room. There's harassment and retaliation charges against an attorney who she has to have a threesome with. There's also a charge in there about her inappropriate hiring and relationship with Stephen Penrose, who is her former church pastor. There's a lot of characters in here.
And she played in a band with that church pastor, right?
Yes.
South of Cincy. And that's not why she's being impeached, though. So we don't know if it was the quality of the band. But we'll look forward to your next coverage of that, because you've been on that case since the beginning, and it's now it's coming from two fronts now, it looks like. So we'll continue to follow that as well. Very quickly, let's touch on the 67th House District race in Campbell County, because there's an election in Kentucky, Northern Kentucky, in just 11 days,
yes.
the 25th of February.
Lots and it's going because, on in Northern Kentucky.
Exactly. Longtime State Representative Dennis Keene stepped down as a state rep to join the Beshear administration as Commissioner of the Department of Local Government. Mm-hmm. So you have Democrat Rachel Roberts, who had previously run for the state Senate there, running against Republican Mary Jo Wedding. Sure. Some Democrats tried to get Mary Jo Wedding kicked off the ballot based mm-hmm. on residency issues. That's now mm-hmm. been resolved.
Yep. So this started in January. Somebody filed a court action saying that Mary Jo Wedding was not living in the district, which is a fundamental thing that you just have to do to represent anybody in any elected position. So the Campbell County Circuit Court held a hearing earlier this week on February 10th, and they ruled that Mary Jo Wedding can stay on the ballot. They followed a paper trail. They looked at her license, her 2018 tax return. They looked at her bank, where her bank statements were being sent, and they all went to this Newport address. So the court ruled that she does and has lived in the district, and her name right now will stay on the ballot.
I mean, they were accusing her of having all kinds of addresses in
right.
Florence and Pendleton County and mm-hmm. different spots in right. Campbell County and just wanted clarity, but it does mm-hmm. look like she came out ahead. So there will be an election mm-hmm. for us all to cover in just 11 days,
yep.
which will excite people. I don't know if it will excite people more than Scott Wartman's best story of the week.
Oh, this is great.
Which the headline, Bigfoot, Grassman, Frogman, Ohio doing pretty well, monster-wise.
It's the story most news agencies will ignore. They don't want you to know about.
But that's why yeah. you're around and protecting our interest. This is a profile of the Loveland Frogman, the Crosswick Monster, some melonheads
yeah.
in Cleveland, and the Mothman in Gallipolis. Am I saying that?
Gallipolis.
Oh, man. I've had to work since I've crossed the river and working. I've had to make sure I say Piqua correctly. Bell Fountain is one that I have to learn. Say that one for me again. So I learned
Gallipolis.
Oh, man, I'm going to have to work on that later.
That's
sorry,
all right.
Listeners. Please don't email us. I'm going to work on
you'll
it.
You'll get it.
Man, okay. Are there any monsters in Northern Kentucky that we should know about?
Oh, lots that you should know about. I'll tell you after. So which one's your favorite that you covered here? Which one has the most lore, do you think?
Well, actually, the Crosswick Monster is one that is not very well known near Waynesville, which was this giant lizard. This was in a the only reference to it was in an 1882 article of the Enquirer, actually.
Oh, wow.
There was a giant – these two boys were fishing in 1882, and this giant lizard came out of nowhere. It was bipedal with – it was like a snake with arms and legs, grabbed one of the kids, tried to – bring the way the story said, tried to drag the kid into a hollow tree, and a whole bunch of villagers literally drove, like an old gothic horror movie, drove the monster out.
That's terrifying.
I'll be honest with you, my favorite one is Mothman, which is it's on the border of Ohio and West Virginia. I mean, West Virginia lays more claim to it, but it actually has the roots in a real life tragedy, a bridge collapse in 1967, killing 46 people. Mm. But in the year leading up to this, this half-moth, half-man creature was spotted, and local news reports were reporting it throughout that whole year. Like, people were seeing this weird creature, and then the bridge collapsed and the sighting stopped. So the theories are it was either a portent of doom, or there's another theory that it was just a sandhill crane, which are gray, 4 feet tall, have red around the eyes. I could go on and on and on.
I know you can.
there's some one real quickly.
Sure.
But why I did the story, because there was a Bigfoot sighting.
Yeah, right.
But Ohio has actually, and what I think distinguishes the Ohio monsters from other monsters, they have a lot of non-Bigfoot or like Loch Ness monsters, like really bizarre,
yeah,
like local
like,
legends.
Exactly. They are very, very cool. And I believe you updated on Twitter, there's one to watch out for in Alms Park as well.
If anyone knows anything about that, that was actually a source in City Hall passed that along to us.
Oh, gosh.
But it just says it's an Alms Park badger, but it doesn't say whether it's like a mutant badger or if it's just a regular badger. And I've not been able to find anything beyond there's just a Wikipedia entry on it. So if anyone has any information about what this Alms Park badger is, I've never heard of it before.
The Alms Park badger, please contact us or Scott Wartman directly. In fact, go ahead and contact Scott Wartman directly if you have any information on that. We'll look forward to the follow-up. Scott Wartman, Julia Fair from the Enquirer, thanks to both of you for coming in. Appreciate the conversation very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, WVXU reporters are here to talk about the week's news from our newsroom, including how Kings Island is trying to quiet down a little bit. And we've got a Valentine's Day discussion about romance and dating in the Queen City. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined now by WVXU reporters Ann Thompson. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Michael.
And Tana Weingartner. Hi, Tana.
Bonjour.
And you are afternoon host this
day. Yeah,
that's
right. And
yeah,
you'll
be all things considered. And you can listen to Ann as your midday host as well today. Let's start with your story, Tana. The first time that you touched on this subject, it really blew up online. Kings Island making a lot of noise. Some of the coasters and some neighbors complained. It looks like now there are actually
They might be getting
steps.
Some remedy. Yes, so we have seen a letter from Cedar Fair, which is the parent company of Kings Island, saying, so basically the problem is, in terms of the neighbors that are living near Kings Island, Diamondback is really loud. It's been really loud for 10 years. It's kind of part of the design of the coaster. When the coaster goes across the tracks, it just makes a lot of noise. And their main concern was that it was making a lot of noise until like 2 in the morning in the fall during things like Halloween Haunt. But over the summer, they discovered that there's a potential solution. You can put sand in the tracks and this damps the sound. So they went back to Kings Island. They're like, hey, apparently you've used this at your other parks, like in Toronto and whatnot. And would you try it here? So long story short, Kings Island, well, Cedar Fair has said they will put sand in the tracks. And Orion is the same type of coaster, which is under construction. So it's being built with the sand in it, as far as I understand. It's not entirely sure when Diamondback will have the full thing in. So Cedar Fair has also said they've hired an acoustic engineer to monitor the sound. They'll come out and take readings. The neighbors, of course, cautiously optimistic, trust but verify, they told me, the old Ronald Reagan line. So they also have an acoustic engineer, and we'll see where it goes.
What a world to live next to an amusement park.
And then a lot of people have said, you knew what you were in for when you signed up. And in at least one case, the neighbor was there before Kings Island. But the other neighbors say, that's true, that's fair, we don't mind when the park closes at 10 o'clock. Like it's supposed to. It's when it stays open late in the fall and these rail cars are going every 60 seconds until like 2 o'clock in the morning. And they also said, you know, when they moved in, they could not have imagined something as loud as Diamondback is. And Orion, like I said, same type of coaster, is expected to be even louder.
But how loud are you on a roller coaster, Tana Weingartner?
Well, okay, so according to my cousins, you have to scream like Mexican food items. So when you're going down the roller coaster, you have to scream like guacamole.
Oh, I didn't know that. You're always full of great information, Tana.
You're welcome.
And we've got some great information from Ann Thompson as well, because you had a conversation.
It won't be as entertaining as Tana's.
We'll find
that's
a way
true.
To make it so. FBI adding a dozen agents here to the Cincinnati office, and you learned a lot during this meeting with
yes,
the FBI.
Yes, so there's a new special agent in charge, Chris Hoffman, and he called the reporters to their Kenwood office, and it turns out he had a lot to say. And so in addition to adding 10 agents, which is kind of unusual from what I understand, and they won't be all at once. It'll be as certain ones retire in New York, then instead of going back there, they'll come to Cincinnati. So there's that. But then also he talked about the Dayton case and the fact that they are wrapping up that. He said, you know, the FBI is investigating, even though the shooter, Connor Betts, is no longer living. They were looking into him and trying to create a mental picture. They're doing that in Quantico, Virginia. And also his associate, Ethan Colley, who has pleaded guilty and will be sentenced soon. Then he also talked about, if you want me to continue on, the Chinese espionage. So that is a huge concern. We continue to hear about people stealing secrets.
You've got a story on this coming up. Is it next week that that's coming
up? Yeah, so on Monday, I'm just going to do the angle where the FBI wants companies and universities help in this. And so, you know, just to let them partner. And he says, you know, Hoffman says, you don't have to be concerned, you know, if we go to your company, like we're not going to be investigating for other things. It's just that we're looking into this. He also cited the Nationwide Children's Hospital case in Columbus, where these two Chinese had worked there for 10 years. They also had a company in their own country, and they were stealing secrets.
Ann Thompson, our midday host, I know you want to get out of here because we're about to start talking about some dating issues. And you are happily married with children.
Well, you make me sound like I'm not a romantic at all, but yes, I am married.
What
so
are you
I
and your
be
husband
going
to do for Valentine's Day?
So I don't know. We kind of haven't decided yet. We might go to a movie. I've already gotten some flowers.
Oh,
and so,
yeah. See?
That's so sweet.
That is so sweet. In fact, now I want you to leave. No, I want you to stick. Why don't you stick around then? Because we've only got 5 minutes anyway.
Okay,
we were going to let you go.
Sure.
We got bumped a little bit with some breaking news from John Cranley at the top of the show. If you missed the top of the show, listen to the replay. He's exploring a run for governor. So we got Tana and Ann still here with us. And let me quickly bring in Julie Neeson, Wine Me, Dine Me writer and WVXU Bits and Bytes contributor. Julie, hi.
Hello.
I'm so sorry I ate up most of your segment. This makes me a bad date, doesn't it?
You're such a terrible date.
I'm a terrible date.
Aww.
What's a great date in Cincinnati?
A great date. Let's see. Gainfully employed.
That makes it helpful.
That's
like if you're a successful person. Where should a person, there's couples out there listening to us possibly, or maybe individuals who are like, oh man, it's Valentine's Day. I forgot we better plan something. What's a great romantic Valentine's Day evening in the Queen City?
At this point, stay home. Seriously.
It's a little gross out. It's cold.
I know. It's gross out. It's cold. And trust me, all of the restaurants you want to go to are probably booked.
Okay.
So think about going to maybe a place that you wouldn't normally think of going on Valentine's Day. For example, I like to get wings on Valentine's Day.
Wings,
because nobody gets wings on Valentine's Day, which means the place is empty and the wings are delicious. And
that's a great tip.
Thank you.
How do you take your wings?
Let's see. I generally like the drumettes and medium.
Yeah.
Garlic.
Okay, so I eat wings with a knife and fork. Would you break up with me?
We've already established this.
Boneless wings or wings with bone?
Well, I don't eat with my hands because, you know.
You have a thing? What?
I do. You remember the picture of Donald Trump that went viral a little while ago where he's eating Kentucky Fried Chicken with a knife and fork? I was like, man, I kind of relate to that. I get
well,
that.
Didn't John Kasich eat pizza with a knife
yes,
and fork?
Yes, I eat pizza with a knife and fork too.
Even like etiquette books say that it's okay to eat fried chicken with the queen with your hands. You're supposed to do that.
Well, that's fine. You guys can get coronavirus. I don't plan to. What about a romantic view? Where's a good place to go see something that's like if you want to just hang out? I know it's a little cold outside, but
romantic
things
view?
Could warm up quickly on Valentine's Day.
That they could. I would say definitely the overlook in Eden Park, but then also the observatory. I mean, you could go to the observatory too. I'm sure they'd love to have you, and that's a great view.
Yeah.
But the overlook on the west side as well, and the name is escaping me. It's not Mount Storm. I'm sure it's
Mount Echo.
I'm sorry?
Mount Echo?
Yes,
yeah,
Mount Echo.
It is Mount Echo.
Mount Echo has a beautiful view of
it
the
does.
City, and I think it's really, really underrated.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Okay, so that's stuff for people who are coupled.
Yes.
Like you.
Yes.
And Anne.
Right.
No.
Not Tana and not Michael. Uh-huh. So we are single ladies on the town tonight. And there are so many mixed reviews on mm-hmm. what it's like to be single in Cincinnati. And a lot of those, you know, goofy websites that sometimes news organizations will pick up if it's funny enough to share. It's things
true.
Like Home Snacks or Wallet Hub will put this out. I'm seeing all over the place ratings for Cincinnati. That's a good place for dating. It's a bad place for dating. I've got one report from Home Snacks that says the best city for dating in Ohio is Norwood.
What? clearly, they've done some data and never actually been here. Because, I mean, if you look at the data and the number of, like, single people proportionally, it's great, but I would not be my first
they
pick.
Always
Rookwood
use
is in Norwood, though.
Rookwood's in Norwood.
That's true.
Nordstrom Rack.
I mean,
I like Nordstrom Rack.
I do like Nordstrom Rack, too. You know, start browsing the whichever aisle you want to find a person who might be looking there, yeah.
And Cincinnati does rank among the top U.S. cities for singles. This is also from a website called Wallet Hub. And this was just a couple of years ago that Cincinnati ranked 25. I saw another one from Home Snacks that said Cincinnati ranks 21 in the country. So there are these mixed reviews. Tana, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, is it difficult to go out and date in this town?
I'm going to go with yes.
But what is it? What does that mean that it's difficult to date? I mean, I personally don't put any effort in to do it. So I can't really judge on what that's like.
Everyone who I talk to who is single and are looking in any sort of way for even friends,
Anne
honestly.
Thompson is now leaving.
Yes.
She asked the question. I thought I had to get out, but no, I'm really asking.
Okay, goodbye.
Just says that the problem is that people marry here so young. So
yeah.
You end
really?
Up. Yeah. So you end up with like this whole like almost 10-year period of your life where there's nobody to date because they've already gotten married, and then you get them on the back end of a divorce.
Mm. That's an interesting, I mean, that jives with my experience. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I guess you just have to get out there though, right?
You really do. In fact, tonight you can go to Queen City Radio, and they are doing a...
Well, it's across the street.
I know, and I'm not being paid to do this.
Oh, are they doing one of those
They're doing
speed,
a speed
They did
speed
it last
dating.
Year.
Yeah,
I remember
they sure
that.
Are. I think I talked about it
I
here last
year.
I
would tell you this. It doesn't matter how desperate I get at some point in my life, I would never Never. Tana, would you do that?
Speed dating?
Yeah.
Not tonight.
Well, thanks to my two Valentines, Tana Weingartner from WVXU and Wine Me, Dine Me writer and WVXU Bits and Bytes contributor Julie Neeson. So good to see both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.